immersed surfaces. Okay. So these will correspond to just surface subgroups of the fundamental group of the three-manifold. Okay, and we'll also just be interested in closed surfaces. So we'll be looking at, you know, surface subgroups for this talk will mean fundamental groups of compact, closed, orientable surfaces of positive genus. Okay, actually at least two for all these. So suppose you have one of these surface subgroups in this hyperbolic three-manifold group, then the sort of fundamental trichotomy here is that there's only three possibilities for the geometry of the surface. Okay, so using these results of Monahan, Marden, and Thurston, we know that either the surface subgroup is quasi-Fuchsian, in which case its limit set is a circle, geometrically infinite, where the limit set is the whole sphere at infinity, or it contains an accidental parabolic element. Okay, so some element of trace 2. Okay, now, of course, the big question is there a surface subgroup inside of gamma? And in general, of course, we don't know the answer to that question. But that won't stop us from asking harder questions. So we'd actually like to know, in the case there is a surface subgroup, what can we say about the geometry of it? Okay, so, well, it sort of splits naturally into two cases. In the closed case, then you never have to worry about possibility C, which I had up. So the only possibilities are that it's quasi-Fuchsian or else geometrically infinite. And, well, sort of in nature, the ones we actually see tend to be quasi-Fuchsian. And it would be very interesting if they were, if there was always a geometrically infinite surface subgroup. This because in that case, you know that it's corresponding to a virtual fiber, so you can conclude that the three-manifold is virtually fibered. So this is Thurston's virtual fiber conjecture, that there should always actually be a geometrically infinite one somewhere. Okay, in the non-compact case, then you actually, for closed surface subgroups, you never have the geometrically infinite situation. So you only have to worry about cases A and C. Either it's going to be quasi-Fuchsian, or it will contain an accidental parabolic element. So you might ask, you know, so again, sort of generically, when you find these surfaces, it seems that they tend to have the accidental parabolics. And so it would be nice to know that there was a quasi-Fuchsian surface subgroup, which actually reflected the geometry of the three-manifold. Okay, so we're just going to be interested in the second case of non-compact things. So we'll just talk about hyperbolic knot complements, which are finite volume hyperbolic three-manifolds with a single cusp. Okay, now in this case, we have the advantage that we actually know the answer to the big question is yes. So there always is going to be a surface subgroup inside of gamma by a result of Cooper, Long, and Reed. Okay, however, the construction is this construction which sort of goes back to Friedman and Friedman of tubing a Seifert surface. So if you take a Seifert surface for a non-fibered knot, you can take two copies of it and attach a very long annulus to the knot, which connects these two Seifert surfaces. And that gives you a map from a closed surface into your, say, knot complement. And if the surface is not a fiber, then Friedman and Friedman showed that, you know, if you make the annulus long enough, that will always give you a surface subgroup. And then Cooper, Long, and Reed showed that, in fact, even if you have something that does fiber, you can sort of still do these things. So the tubing automatically introduces parabolic elements, because you'll have this curve on the surface which is homotopic to the boundary torus, and so it will be parabolic. Okay, so these are never quasi-Fuchsian. And so our result is that, so joint with Xingru Zhang, that in fact there always is a quasi-Fuchsian closed surface subgroup in a hyperbolic knot complement. Okay, and so then these quasi-Fuchsian surfaces are nice. One thing that's nice about them is that they automatically survive surgeries. So the corollary is that for any hyperbolic knot complement, there's this essential immersed surface, which remains essential after all but finitely many Dehn fillings on the knot. Well, so there's an argument there. Actually, the argument I'm going to give in a few minutes about the approach to proving this, maybe we'll indicate a little bit about why that's true. But it's sort of a standard argument. And, okay, now this is, you know, in particular, this implies that all the finitely many Dane fillings on a hyperbolic knot contain surface subgroups. Okay, and this was already known by Cooper and Long. So the new thing here is that there's a single surface which is surviving all the finitely many of these surgeries. Okay, so I'll spend the rest of the time talking about the proof. And sort of very vaguely, the idea is to try to construct a simple three-manifold, not in the technical term of the word simple, but a well-behaved three-manifold, Y, say, which has a convex, you know, a hyperbolic structure with convex boundary. And one of those boundary components, say, is quasi-Fuchsian. It may have a cusp somewhere else, so there may be accidental parabolics for other things. But you'd like, say, one of the boundary components to have to be quasi-Fuchsian, pi 1 injective. And you would like a map which is locally isometric from this three-manifold Y into M. Okay, so that's a lot to ask, but supposing you could do all that, then there's a fairly standard sort of argument which shows then that your three-manifold M does contain a quasi-Fuchsian surface. Okay, so here's the argument. Given all this stuff, suppose that there was some, you start with an arbitrary loop gamma in this surface group. Okay, well, since this thing has convex boundary, and since there's no accidental parabolics on this component, then you can homotop that to a closed geodesic. Okay, then, since this is a local isometry, the image of that geodesic will be a geodesic in M. Okay, and so since it's a geodesic in M, it has to be correspond to a non-parabolic element in M, a non-zero non-parabolic element in M. So therefore, the image of the surface group is quasi-Fuchsian. Okay, and so back to your question. So as far as showing that a quasi-Fuchsian surface survives all but finitely many fillings, it's a similar sort of argument. You say that you have this quasi-Fuchsian surface, then you look at the convex core, and that will map by a local isometry into M. And then if you can, so then if you use the sort of 2-pi theorem or 6th theorem in the knot complement, you can get a local isometry into the Dane-filled manifolds, which, if you fill along a long enough curve, this the image of this convex core will miss the torus that you're filling along, and so you'll get a local isometry from your convex core into this negatively curved manifold, and so that'll automatically be pi 1 injective by this argument. So the first time I saw this argument was in a paper of Cooper and Long. I'm not sure what the history of that is. Okay, so, the task is to build the manifold Y then. So where is this manifold Y coming from? Okay, and so the starting point is a result of Culler and Shalen, which says that if you look at the truncated manifold, okay, so if you remove a cusp from the knot complement, you get this compact thing, and it will have two distinct boundary slopes. Okay, so there'll be two slopes on this boundary torus, which are represented by incompressible surfaces, which are actually embedded. And in fact, you can take those things to be quasi-Fuchsian. Okay. So the first try is to try to form a three-manifold Y by just taking a little product neighborhood of both of those two surfaces, taking their union, and then capping it off with the cusp. Okay, so that'll give you this this non-compact three-manifold. It'll have a compact boundary component corresponding to sort of the boundary of this regular neighborhood together with these little disks that you're capping off along the boundary torus, and then it'll have a cusp end. Okay, and actually, you know, you do get a hyperbolic structure on that thing because, you know, just coming from M. And so, you know, you do get a local isometric map somehow from some sort of hyperbolic thing into M. But of course, it doesn't have a convex boundary because you have these corners. Okay. So, the basic philosophy is to try to smooth out those corners to get something convex. Okay, so you might try to replace it with a picture that looks like that. Okay, and, well, that may not work. Okay, so you need enough room in order to do this smoothing operation. So, you know, you're adding some extra stuff here, and for instance, if there was topology inside this little bit, you wouldn't actually be able to do that. So, you try to salvage this approach by, instead of using those original surfaces, you want to replace those with finite covers. And then you thicken up the finite covers, and you try to stick those finite covers cross I together in some way, and then cap the resulting thing off somehow with a cusp and map it all into M. Okay, so there are issues. Well, the first question is, how are you going to do this gluing? You know, before I was just taking a union, so there wasn't much issue about how to actually do the gluing. But in general, if you just have these two surface cross eyes and you want to stick them together, you have to say exactly how you're going to stick them together. So, and, you know, the pieces that you stick them together along may not be quite so simple. So the first step is to say exactly how to glue them together. And then the smoothing operation, obviously, I didn't say very much about, and you have to make that precise, exactly what goes on when you're smoothing this out. So the basic idea is that you're just sticking on some extra stuff to make it smooth, and you have to make that precise. And then the key question is, how exactly do you find these covers and make it all work? Okay, and for this last part, it turns into sort of an algebraic problem having to do with subgroup separability. Okay, so let's sort of take those in order. The first part is how to do the gluing. Okay, so what do you use to glue with, first of all? And it's sort of easy to see in the case that you have totally geodesic surfaces. Okay, so in this case, you take this little product neighborhood and, you know, you just have this totally geodesic surface cross I. So when they intersect, they would just intersect along arcs, geodesic arcs. And so the gluing pieces you would use would just look like, you know, little neighborhoods of arcs. Okay, so it's fairly clear what that would look like. And then, you know, the result would just be, you know, I've sort of tried to illustrate these gluing pieces here along the boundary torus. You know, each of these arcs runs from one point of intersection along the boundary torus to another point of intersection along the boundary torus. And so you stick the guys together like that. Okay, now, they may not be totally geodesic, and the intersection may be more complicated than just an arc. So in fact, on the algebraic level here, the fact that these intersect in arcs corresponds to the fact that the intersection of these two surface subgroups is trivial. And that may not be the case in general. So it may be that if you let gamma I, you know, sort of define some, use some base point to define surface subgroups inside of gamma corresponding to these two surfaces, and the intersection of these two groups may not be trivial, but it will, in fact, be finitely generated. Just because these are quasi-Fuchsian, you can show the intersection is finitely generated. So that means it will correspond to some sort of possibly immersed submanifold in S1 and in S2. So you're not necessarily going to be able to stick them together in the embedded case at all along these things. So the very first thing you would have to do is sort of make this be embedded. Okay, but what is it actually going to look like, supposing it was just sort of an embedded submanifold of S1 and S2? Well, let's see. So I tried to draw a picture over here. I'm not sure I really succeeded. But, you know, you'll have this sort of intersection piece, which I'm calling Ki, and then sort of in one direction it flares off to be part of S2, and another direction it flares off to be part of S1. But but they overlap along this sort of subsurface. Okay, but the key is that we don't really care so much about what's happening in the middle. The key to all this is to just pay attention to what's happening along the cusp. And we have a very nice picture of what this will look like along the cusp. It'll just look like sort of, well, schematically like I've drawn it here. Each point of intersection of these two surfaces will correspond to a little square of this gluing piece. And, you know, well, the square will have four edges. Two of those edges will correspond to S1. Two of the edges will correspond to S2. And so that's exactly the picture of the intersection of this hyperbolic manifold with the cusp. Okay, and so, you know, each of these squares, you know, each of these intersection points of the two boundary slopes will correspond to, well, something like a spike of this three manifold, Ki. So I guess sometimes it's Ki, sometimes it's just K, whatever. So once you have this picture, if you know that this is embedded in both S1 cross I and S2 cross I, then you can just stick them together along that embedded submanifold. Okay, and again, the key point is that we know what the parabolic region looks like. So schematically, if this were the gluing piece, then this is sort of how it's connecting everything. So instead of having two, for this particular example, instead of having two disconnected, you know, two components connecting the four intersection points, you might just have a single gluing piece connecting all four. Okay, so that was step one. So the next step was how to do the smoothing. And I should mention that Mark Baker and Daryl Cooper have recently done a lot of very similar stuff and showed how you can sort of do convex gluing of hyperbolic three-manifolds in a more general sense. So in fact, hyperbolic n-manifolds in this more general setting. And they actually proved a lot of nice applications of this to the study of hyperbolic three-manifolds. So a lot of the stuff that is in this section is sort of overlapped with that paper. But the basic idea is probably familiar to a lot of people in the room here. So if you have two sort of hyperbolic manifolds which are intersecting, if you want to smooth them out, you just need to make sure that they have sort of enough room. So you have to make sure this intersection region has a large collar neighborhood in both of the two pieces. And then you can sort of stick some extra stuff on so that they fit together nicely. Okay, so that's the non-technical version of it. Okay, so once we have all this sort of stuff figured out, then we can try again to try to build this manifold Y. Okay, well, again, the first thing we'll want to do is replace our given surfaces with finite covers. Okay, and then we'll look at the intersection subgroups. Okay, and we may have to look at several different intersection subgroups corresponding to, you know, different points of intersection of the two boundary slopes will correspond with different conjugates of some of these groups gamma I. So we look at various conjugates, and we look at their intersections, and each of those will correspond to some gluing piece, Ki. Okay. And then we use that gluing piece, you know, we truncate it, we make it look nice on the cusp, and we use that to stick together these surface cross eyes. Okay, and so the nice thing about it is that when we stick things together, we sort of know what's happening along the boundary. Okay, so that, for instance, if we use this gluing piece to stick together sort of manifolds like this, then we would know that after doing that, we would get a manifold which we could cap off because we've sort of resolved all of these intersections. Okay, so then once we've stuck those things together, we'd like to sort of cap off with a cusp. Okay, so let's just try to do an illustration of how this might work. Okay, so suppose that we have two surfaces which just have two boundary components each, and the boundary components have distance 1, so you have exactly this pattern on the boundary torus. And suppose that the two surfaces are, in fact, totally geodesic. Okay, so the same picture I sort of drew a little while ago. Okay, well, so then, you know, these intersections correspond to arcs on the two surfaces. There's some kind of a parity rule about how the arcs go between the two different boundary components. And we want to replace these surfaces with finite covers. So, you know, there might not be enough room to stick these together as there is, so we might replace them with finite covers that look kind of like this. Okay, so after we've replaced them with finite covers, so now suppose that these arcs have big collar neighborhoods in the two surfaces there. So then we have to cap them off with a cusp. Okay, and that can be problematic. So what you would like to make sure is that these distances that these arcs are separated by are evenly spaced. So that if you look at how these wrap around along this, we could sort of write a cover of this boundary torus that looks like this, such that when you develop this picture onto this lift, you know, this, 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 and this is exactly an m by m by m square. Okay, that would be nice. So then you could just stick this torus here directly, you know, you could stick these two things together along these intersection arcs, and you could plop the entire thing onto that torus and put a cusp on the end, and you could get a manifold. Okay, so that's how it might work. So then you want to show that that actually does work. Okay, so the key things that are needed. Well, of course, we have to get these intersection pieces, you know, to gluing pieces to lift to embeddings. Okay, and those embeddings have to have the big collar neighborhoods. So then we can do the convex gluing. But then the extra condition is we need the spacing to work. Okay, so we need to know that we have the even spacing. Okay, and in order to make that work, we impose this extra condition that the number of boundary components in each of the covers remains the same. You never introduce extra boundary components in these covers, because if you did, well, so right, I mean, formally this condition is not necessarily necessary, but if you have extra components lying around, then those extra components run into each other, and you lose, you know, the more boundary components you have here, the more gluing pieces you need, is sort of the idea. Because all of the intersections of all of these immersed surfaces need to be resolved. So when you have extra boundary components, you have to include extra gluing pieces. And the more gluing pieces you need, you sort of lose your control over the large collar neighborhood. Okay, so that's the third condition, is that in these finite covers of the surfaces, the number of boundary components must remain the same. Okay, so once you have that list of properties, you have some hope of doing things. So the next step is to translate those properties into some group theoretic problem, which you hope to solve. Okay, now the spacing stuff is a real mess, and so I don't want to tell you exactly how that translates. But if we just look at conditions A and C here, so we have these certain submanifolds, you know, certain subsurfaces of a given surface, which we want to lift to embeddings with large collar neighborhoods, and we want the number of boundary components of those covers to remain the same. Okay, so that's a fairly concrete sort of two-dimensional topology problem. So can you do that? Okay, so and that problem can be translated into algebra. Okay, and that's sort of the last thing here. So if you didn't have the condition on the boundary components being the same, it would just be a standard argument having to do with subgroup separability, or LERF. Okay, and so free, you know, and we're always looking at surfaces with boundaries, so the groups in question are free groups, and free groups are LERF by result of Marshall Hall from a long time ago. So that part would be standard. So the difficulty is adding the other part, that the number of boundary components remains constant. So can you, so in order to do that, you need a stronger version of this LERF. So I've been calling, to myself, I call this SLERF. I don't ask anybody else to. So suppose you have a surface with boundary, and you pick some generators like this, and so these will be sort of the generators from the surface of genus G, and then we have these boundary components. And then the last boundary component, you know, can be written in terms of all the other relators or generators. Okay, so in particular it's a free group, but we'd like to keep track of all this data here. So here's the result. So if you have any finitely generated subgroup of this free group, and suppose the finitely generated subgroup has no peripheral elements. Okay, so that means that, you know, from a topological point of view, nothing in this subgroup is freely homotopic to the boundary. Okay, now take any collection of elements Y, which are disjoint from your given subgroup H. Okay, so then there exists some integer n, so that there's an index n subgroup containing your given subgroup H, right, J contains H. It misses all of these Y's that you're trying to exclude, and it has this extra property that the boundary components all unwrap as many times as they possibly can. So if it's an index n subgroup, the most they could possibly unwrap is, you know, sort of 1 to n minus 1. Okay, so that's what happens, is that none of these elements x to the I will be in J for any boundary component, you know, any x and x and any I less than n. Okay. So the only, if I covered that up, this would just be like the Lerf statement. So the extra hypothesis is this last bit. And this is saying that the number of boundary components stays the same because they all unwrap as much as they possibly can. Oh. Number of boundary components are the same. Yeah. Sorry, you've only been getting 50% of all the slides, I guess. So. Okay. Okay, so, you know, that's a very algebraic statement, but if you want to think about this topologically, so here's a topological consequence. So if you have a hyperbolic surface, say, with some number of boundary components, and if you have some immersed geodesic, well, the Lerf property would say that you can always lift it to an embedding in some finite cover. And so the extra information here is you can lift it to an embedding in a finite cover without increasing the number of boundary components. Okay, so this was a lot of work, that that strong Lerf thing. So let me just... it seems to be quite a bit harder than regular Lerf. So let me just give sort of an illustration of how this would all work. So it turns into a purely combinatorial problem. Okay. So, right, so let's just think about Lerf, first of all. So Lerf says, suppose you're given sort of two collections of elements, some guys that you want to lift and some guys that you want to separate. Okay, so suppose we're in a free group of rank 2 here, generated by A and B. Okay, so in this example, let's say that, so the guys we want to lift are, so here I guess we're just lifting one guy, A, B to the minus 2, A inverse. Okay, so this path here corresponds to this element that you're trying to lift. So take all those guys that you're trying to lift, and represent them as, loops in a labeled graph like this. Okay, and you want these to be folded loops, so you don't want to allow a picture like this. If you see a picture like this, two words with the same endpoint, two letters with the same endpoint, you have to collapse them. So this is the folding operation of Stallings. Okay, so you take your H, your subgroup H, and you sort of represent it by some collection of folded, labeled, loops. Okay, and then you have this other subgroup, Y. Was it Y? I forget what I called it. Yeah, Y. And you don't want those guys to lift. So these are the bad guys. And so, say in this example, they would be like B inverse, A inverse. So here's my base point, and B. Okay, so you take those guys and you represent those as paths. You know, just write these as sort of non-closed paths, and you stick them onto the base point, and you fold them onto the rest of what you had. Okay, and the assumption that this set is disjoint from this subgroup will tell you that after you do all the folding, then the endpoints of these paths will actually still be distinct from the base point you started with. So they will still be paths and not loops. Okay, so now how do you construct the cover, you know, the finite index subgroup of the free group? Well, you know, think of it as the free group as the fundamental group of this wedge of circles. And so all you have to do then is extend this graph to a cover of this wedge of circles. And that's actually, you know, easy to do. You just have to add in, anytime you have sort of a missing edge, you can just add an edge in, okay? And you just have to avoid any of these folds. You don't want to add any forbidden edge, which would create a fold. But there's no obstruction to just taking this picture and completing it to get a regular graph which covers this wedge of circles. So that's how you prove LRF. Okay, now to prove this stronger LRF, you have to have an additional restriction. So if I have the free group of rank 2 here, then what you'll have to make sure is that the commutator has to unwind as much as possible in this graph. So you have to complete this somehow to a regular graph so that if you follow along the path corresponding to this commutator, it will hit all of these vertices exactly once. Okay, so that's a little sort of game you can play. And, oh, crap. I just wrote on the, no, I didn't. Good. That's on the internet now, actually, isn't it? All right. Right. Okay, so here's how this particular example might work out. So you have to complete this to a regular graph. Now, you're allowed to add vertices. If you're not allowed to add vertices, you'll never be able to do this. So you're allowed to add as many vertices as you want, and then you complete the thing to a regular graph, and you have to have this property that the commutator hits all the vertices exactly once. Okay, so let's see what happens to this example. So I tried this like 4 times, and the last time I tried it worked, so hopefully that means this works. So if I do A, B, A inverse, B inverse, so I've hit 1 vertex, then A, B, A inverse, B inverse, 2, there's 9 vertices total here, so A, B, A inverse is 3, A, B, A inverse is 4, A, B, A inverse is 5, A, B, B inverse is 6, A, B, A inverse is 7, A, B, B inverse is 8. This is not going to be very interesting on the internet either, actually. A, B, A inverse. Well, whatever. So I claim that works, and I think it does. But that time I got more than 9, so. Anyway, so it turns out that you can do this. It's a combinatorial issue. And actually, I should say, I mean, you might think that you could do it just by adding sort of a few vertices, and perhaps you can. I guess I don't know. But we had to do some sort of drastic moves to, you know, the number of vertices that are used, sort of the degree of the cover that you get, sort of kind of blows up a little bit. So you might have to take there's certain steps where you have to attach sort of like a number of different copies of this graph. And, you know, so the number of vertices goes way up. But it turns out that it does work. So that's how you prove the theorem. Thanks. Yeah, well, so I skipped that part. So then once you have this Y, this manifold Y, you have to actually look at what it is. And, you know, so it has some sort of topological structure that is relatively easy to understand. And then you just look at the boundary component and you just show topologically that there are no annuli. Yeah, it's a topological argument at that point. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so the number of vertices goes up. But it's always finite. You get a finite cover at the end.